coming to you live from the Alphabet Uprising. I'm Johannes Stauffer, and with me, as always, is the new king and first letter, Q. And this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode 9er, Great Hug, Good Buddy!
Is this thing on? Is it turned on? Are we live?
I would like to just congratulate Tom for making a tapping the mic noise with his mouth rather than actually tapping the mic because he knew I would yell at him.
Yeah, you always get mad at me when I do things.
I'm so proud.
Anything that I might do, you get angry about.
Yep.
Like, you're mad right now, aren't you?
It's on, by the way, yes.
Is it? Okay, so this is going out on the air?
Mm-hmm.
Like, people are listening
live.
Right now?
Yeah,
live. We're live.
As in coming to them live.
Right, at the moment.
From a bowl of guacamole.
The words that we're saying are going out and they're listening to them.
Uh-huh.
So we should probably start the show, right?
Right.
It's that
time. I'm Johannes Stauffer, and with me, as always, is Creamy Green Moisture.
Yeah. And this is the part where we start the actual show?
And this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast.
This is the actual bit? This is it? Now?
Mm-hmm.
Now?
Mm-hmm.
Now.
Now.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. I'm Tom Rich. Glad to have you here.
And I'm Johannes Stauffer, and I'm fairly ambivalent.
That means he can walk with both feet.
Mm-hmm. That's why I'm such a fabulous dancer.
And this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Good to have you. Glad that you chose to spend your weeknight or weekday or weekend, night, day.
Depending on the time zone you're in.
Right. With us.
While you're listening to our live podcast.
We twain. We happy twain. We band of men.
Men.
Men boys. Mans. Boy men. Boys to men. We got a great show for you tonight. We're really excited. Patrick Stewart is here, but per his contract, he will not be speaking or asked any questions or participate in any way.
Correct.
But he is here. I'm rubbing his bald head as we speak.
Also in his contract.
Yes. But more salient to you, the reader of the podcast, is the topic for tonight. Tonight's topic is a fan favorite, or at least a Chip Beauvais favorite.
So a fan.
Sure. Wrong about books.
Favorite. Let's try that again while I'm not stepping on your line.
Wrong about books.
We probably have a musical sting of some sort.
We do. I think we do. I think it's where one of us makes a sound.
Okay.
Yeah. So Wrong About Books, welcome back, is the segment where we talk about a book and are probably incorrect about it because we are, what's the word I want here, Johannes?
Brilliant.
Genius, and so we're so smart that it circles back around to appear as stupidity to the untrained eye.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. God, this is the worst podcast on the internet.
No, it's not.
Fair enough. Okay, so tonight's Wrong About Books. We will be incorrect regarding a book called The Magicians by one Lev Grossman. That is the book that we'll be talking about. And Wrong About Books tradition is that we give a short description of the book, then a up or down on it, which means...
With the thumb.
With
the thumb is up
thumb,
or down.
The thumb is the up or down, which means if that description made you, I'd check that out. The thumbs up means, yes, you'll probably buy it if you liked the description, or no, even, and a no would mean, even if you liked the description, it's probably not going to live up to your expectations.
Yeah.
Then we'll take, we do a little bit of silence, just some quiet time where we can all meditate and reflect.
Think about our feelings.
And then we come back with the full spoilery review discussion, fist fight, whatever it may be.
Yep. We've never really established the number of thumbs each of us is allowed to give up, down, or otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Should we do that now?
I think any number, I don't even think you have to stick with thumbs. Just whatever you want to stick in the air is great.
Okay.
Just wave it around.
Uh-huh.
You just put stuff up.
That's not a real helpful rating system. Maybe we should amend it. To say, like, we each have two thumbs.
Yeah, but the amendment process for our podcast constitution requires 2/3 of all hosts to agree on something, and we know that's not going to happen. So.
Right, right. It oddly requires exactly 2/3. Yeah. If it is more or less, it fails.
So, like, I've tried to get just Johannes' lower parts to concur, and they won't.
Because they don't have any thumbs.
Right. So it just doesn't... It's not the best government, but it's the one that we have, so we go with it, you know?
The real question is, how did it ever get established with those rules?
Well, it didn't have those rules before it was established.
I gotcha.
Those rules were what were established during the podcast Constitutional Convention, which had all of the greatest minds that were available at the founding of the podcast, which explains a lot.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
It was just you and also me.
So we'll give thumb and or thumbs up and or
fingers
down.
Or toes or noses.
Left
or
ear.
Butts.
Not the right one.
Just waving your butt in the air.
Yeah.
Waving it around. You just got to shimmy a bit. That's how we do that.
Knees, tentacles. I mean, shh,
yeah. Ixnay on the tentacles, tay. Well, they'll play well in Japan.
That was the easy joke. I was trying to figure out what tentacles tay sounded like, you know, like on a menu.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't get there. You beat me.
I let it be known that I rarely, if ever, skip the easy joke.
That's a fair point.
Mm-hmm. So, The Magicians by Lev Grossman.
Tom is going to give us a brief synopsis.
Is a book about a man named Quentin Coldwater, who is a...
He's more of a boy.
Sure.
To start.
Yeah, he's like 19, I think.
No, I think he's 17. He's not even graduated from
high school. Oh, he's a child.
Yeah.
He's a child boy.
He is a children.
He is a young, a larva. But he is sad and trying to get into Ivy League schools and in New York, and it's not good for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he is invited to be at Magic College instead.
Yep.
And so he goes to Magic College, the Breakbills Academy of Magic, where he learns to be a magician and also learns...
I think that was spoilers already.
Oh, oops. Do you want to try it again?
Yeah.
Okay. So, The Magician's concerns itself...
Actually, do you want to just bleep that?
The whole thing?
No, just that part. The last part. We'll beep that.
That was spoilery, you think?
I think so.
Okay. Well...
Because it doesn't... You can see it coming, but it's never actually said to be true until like the last third quarter of the book.
The story concerns Quentin, his adventures in magic school, and his adventures after magic school as well.
Yes.
Kind of, I think, is a fair summary. It's been described on the internet in some places as adult Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Which, in the spoilery section, we'll get into some disputations we've got with that. But I think if you don't take that, if you take that loosely and not tightly.
Very loosely. I would say, without even going into spoilers, don't go into it expecting adult Harry Potter. The similarities begin and end with magical boarding school.
Fair enough. Yeah. Also, it's a show on Sci-Fi too, which is how I found out about it. So you could also watch that if you wanted to.
Yep.
But anyway, so if that description sounds fun to you, Johannes, what do you think? Are you an up or a down on that one?
Well, as you were describing it, I was kind of going about the place collecting all the thumbs that I could find,
mm-hmm.
and all of them are down.
All of them.
I didn't count them real carefully, but it's somewhere between 14 and 96
Is that why all of my neighbors are outside screaming and why there are like 30 cop cars queuing up out front of my house?
No, they were doing that before.
Oh, why are they doing that? Do you know?
I didn't ask. I just got their thumbs and came right back in.
Fair enough.
Yep.
Yeah, I would give it just a big old sideways thumb all the way across.
Really, you're being fairer to it than I expected.
Like, you'll probably not be miserable if that sounded... Wow, that was talk about damning with faint praise.
Right.
You'll probably not hate it if that sounded like it was your jam. But I don't know that you'll go away... happy.
I will grant some caveats to my 14 to 96 thumbs down.
Mm-hmm.
One is that if you go in expecting adult Harry Potter, you will be disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be all of the thumbs that you could ever have seen in your life down. If you don't go in expecting that, you don't have as great a height to fall from. Or rather, it doesn't have as great a height to fall from. That's one caveat. Another caveat is that even... as much as I didn't care for it, and I talked to Tom about this a bit before, we'll probably go into it more after the break, it didn't
really lose my attention. There are books I've read. There are better books I've read that I had a harder time getting through. Mm-hmm. It's an easy enough read.
Mm-hmm. So if you're on an airplane.
Yeah, it fits firmly in the forgot to bring something to read and bought this off a spinning rack at the airport.
Oh, shoot. I'm stuck in this tire change joint for four or six hours. Luckily, there's a Barnes & Noble across the parking lot. Let me go buy a cheap paperback and hope for the best.
Yeah, that kind of deal.
Yeah. And then I will abandon it here because I don't have a shelf for it at home.
Yep. I had a third caveat, but I've forgotten what it was.
That's fair.
Which is fine.
Oh, we did forget our second piece of criteria that we do before the break, too, which is Mrs. Johannes's mom, if you're listening, should you read this book as well?
Absolutely not.
All right, there we go. You will not enjoy it, Mrs. Stauffer.
So it does, again, without getting too spoilery, I think it hits some of the sort of teen paranormal romance notes, which I think are pretty much garbage across the board.
I would argue it's not actually teen paranormal romance. It's just
teen romance in a paranormal setting.
Teen romance in a paranormal setting, which is the kind of douchey distinction that I would make.
Well, yeah.
But
a master's in creative writing will do that to a guy. Well, should we move on to the brief silence before the spoilers?
I don't know that we can say anything more intelligent about it without it.
Yeah.
It's not so bad that you will throw it away in disgust, most likely. You'll probably make it through and then forget about it a week later. That's about where we're at, I think. If it sounds like your jam.
One more way to maybe help someone figure out whether or not they should bother to read this book. And if you do, I would recommend you get it from your local library rather than giving any money of your own that you earned through work to the author or anyone for it, really. Get it for free. Which we did not do, and it was a very expensive ebook, let me say. All of that, I've forgotten what I was going to say about it. I'm really good at this podcast. Host business.
Your mind is really just sharp tonight.
Yeah, yeah.
You wouldn't make it very long at break, Bills. Right? Let's take a break. We'll give you a little...
Bills.
Give it a few seconds of silence here, and then we're going to come back and... win some hockey games. I mean, talk about the book.
Oh, wait, hold on.
You found it.
I think.
Okay, go.
If you are the sort of person, since we danced around what teen paranormal romance even is, if you're the sort of person who would read Twilight, you would probably like this book okay. I feel like I can say that.
Sure.
Comfortably. I think that's all.
Okay.
I might have had more to say, but I feel like that sums it up.
Okay.
Now the silence part, and then the spoiler part. After the silence part, which is now.
Is this the silence part?
It's right. Not yet. Hold on. Almost. Now.
This one?
Mm-hmm.
Is now?
Yep.
Right now.
As soon as you stop making noise.
So now.
Now.
Now?
Now.
Now.
Then.
All right, let's talk about The Magicians. Holy crap.
This book was a pile of garbage.
What happened?
Just a dumpster fire from beginning to end.
Okay, so let's do a quick plot summary for the spoilerific part of the show here about the magical Ians.
A whiny teenager who is completely unsympathetic in every way gripes about a bunch of crap you could never possibly care about while living in a magical universe where there is magic.
So Q-Dog...
The end.
Our narrator, our protagonist, Q-Dog Chili Water
is
his name.
Yep.
Which is like a chili dog, but you just put the sauce in the water instead and drink it.
Disgusting,
right? He's clearly has some breed of depression and or anxiety. Like, that's his defining character trait, is he's sad.
Okay, without going too far into it yet, he's supposed to come across that way.
Sure.
He is not that way.
He goes to break bills, he goes through and graduates and gets his magical degree in magic, and he then discovers afterward that the world of Fillory, which is the world from these books that he read as a child, is real.
Yeah.
And that he and his friends are going to go there where they unravel the mystery of what happened to the Chatwin children, who were the children in the book that went to Fillory.
Fillory is Narnia. Chatwins are Pevensies.
Yeah. If you've read Narnia, you get the general idea.
Yeah.
They solve the problem. They murder the horrible beast that is ruling Fillory and that murdered a dude at Breakbills while Quentin was there.
Yeah.
A gal, actually, murdered a student. Mm-hmm. And then Quentin is sad for a while, and then at the end they decide to go back and be kings and queens in Fillory because Narnia.
Yeah.
It's about a reasonable summary of some sort.
Yeah, yeah.
Leaves out a lot
very
of stuff
briefly,
that goes on.
But yeah.
And so Quentin's whole deal the entire time, throughout the entire book, is that he's a sad sack.
Yeah.
He's just sad, and he's an unhappy man, and he finds, like, he keeps running up the mountain like, oh, this is the thing that will finally give meaning to my life, and then falling off of that mountain.
So I think there's a distinction to be made that I think he's trying even to make, failing miserably, but trying to make in the book, between sad and unhappy. I don't think Quentin is generally sad. Mm-hmm. And I would really contest that he is depressed. He doesn't have any of the signs of depression, really.
Mm-hmm.
He's just bored. Mm-hmm. Like, he as a character doesn't understand what happiness is. It's more amusement.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like, oh, this new thing makes me happy for a while. Oh, it doesn't make me happy forever. This sucks.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gripes and mopes around for a while.
Yeah, he keeps falling off that trail. He goes to Breakbills and he starts learning frickin' magic.
Yeah.
And that's really cool for all. And then it's just like, oh, now I have such ennui again. I just have this general sense of malaise. And then he graduates. He's like, oh, me and all of my friends now live in Brooklyn and we're cool magicians and we don't have to worry about money because we're magicians. And that's cool. And we can be as hedonistic as we want. And I got a girlfriend and it's great. And then he sinks into this malaise. And then he's like, oh, great. I'm in Fillory and I'm literally living in my childhood fantasy world where everything is great. And there's a bear that I'm talking to. And then he's got this general malaise. Only he never really, in a lot of cases, actually ever climbs that mountain.
Yeah.
Even like he's just like he gets to Fillory and you're expecting, oh, this is the world he's been talking about, is his childhood world where the things were. And he's just sort of a sad sack whiny from the get go.
Like from the beginning.
We never get any differentiated. He's just that. And that would be fine if he weren't the protagonist. I didn't have to live in his head the entire book.
Yeah.
And even like you've got two options as a writer here. I think you got a couple of options. You can either have the sad sack character who is the sad sack character the entire time.
Right.
And not make them the protagonist. And that's good. Or you can put me in the sad sack character's head, and I'm going to be annoyed with him for the beginning, for the while, but you got to show him progressing. Even if he never gets to normal, functional person who's not sad all the time,
mm-hmm.
you've got to show him wrestling with it and trying to triumph and moving there, because that's what books are. They're about characters overcoming their challenges, whether internal or external.
Yeah.
And Quentin never does dick.
Yeah.
He doesn't do anything to try to overcome his internal challenges.
No.
He doesn't participate in overcoming the external challenges. It's almost always another character that does it for him.
Yep.
When he runs across Antarctica through magic, that's a thing he does on his own. When he tries to fly to the moon and then gives up, that's a thing he does kind of on his own a little bit.
Yeah,
but he gives up. And then in Fillory, other characters do everything. Quentin doesn't contribute.
And toward the end, after the main story arc is over and he's still in Fillory becoming some sort of incredible mage, it's not impressive and it doesn't matter and he doesn't care about it and you don't care about it.
Yeah.
And then he goes home and he's like, and now I'm not going to do magic anymore.
I'm going to just be a consultant at a management firm. And but because I'm a magician, I can have that job and not have to do anything.
Not do any work.
And just sit around playing video games all day. And that's somehow better?
Yeah, it was.
And then the three, they show up and they go to Fillory and whatever. That's the end. The end
that's
is them
the
going
end
back
the
to
first
Fillory.
Book.
That's
yeah.
the end of the book. And we're not going to read the
which,
second and third.
Terrifyingly, if I understood that interview with the author correctly, was how the book was supposed to end before he ever decided to write a second one. That was his wrapped up the story.
Yeah. I'm just like, why is Q-Dog here my protagonist? Why, what? There's just nothing to him.
Yeah.
I'm like, be a protagonist here. And like, I'm annoyed as a reader because, you know, everybody's annoyed as a reader by this guy. But I'm just annoyed by Quentin.
Yep.
I'm annoyed by him repeatedly. He just doesn't work. He doesn't work as a character. There's no, I didn't detect any discernible growth as a person or reason for me to want to be in his life for 300 pages or however the hell long it was.
There's a thing that the author does where I think he's trying to take the struggling, sort of either finding that mountaintop high and mm-hmm. then falling from it as it becomes boring, or struggling towards something and then not getting there, where in a few different places, you'll just like, it's not even a monologue, you'll just be inside Quentin's head for like a couple pages, mm-hmm. and he'll have been depressed for a while about how crap everything is, even though he thought this would be the magical panacea for his faux depression. And he will like get worse and worse and worse, like very, very quickly in mm-hmm. this, in his head. And then at the end of it, you're like, oh man, this is going to be the turning point where like he gets really bad. And there are like two miserable chapters before something incredible happens to turn it all around. Mm-hmm. But instead, in like the last paragraph of that thing, he'll just be like, and for no apparent reason, this is how I realized that everything is okay. And then he's just okay for a while until he gets grumpy about something else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like the closest you ever come to seeing any sort of development happen to the character.
Yeah, it just doesn't do what I need it to do.
It doesn't do anything.
Yeah. Did you have any more to say about the sort of the high-level character arc-y stuff before we...
Yeah, like, I just want to take a moment to dump on Quentin a little bit more and his friends, because they're all, or at least mostly, terrible people.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that aren't terrible are not terrible only because they're not in the book enough to have the opportunity to be as terrible as the rest of the ones that you see.
They're all hedonists. Just
yeah.
out and out.
Like, exactly that.
Yeah.
That.
Just we're it's all booze. And like this is the other thing that threw me. And I just thought of this today while driving in my car on the roads that I travel.
Uh-huh.
They get out of magic school.
Right.
And they go to New York.
Yep.
Well, no, hold on. Let me, they get out of magic school and they don't have anything they have to do.
Right.
There's no magical job they have to get. Money is not an object because there's like magical trust funds set up for all magicians. And magicians in this setting can more or less just do what they want. Like, they would have no trouble just being like, I have food now that I have. This is the food that I can get with my powers. Here's the shelter that I made with the power that I control. And so on. So they leave school. They have this tremendous, overwhelming power, and they just want to have some fun with it. You know, they're like, okay, we're going to live it up. We're going to just, boom, go sky high. It's going to be great. What does this descent into hedonism look like for them?
They go out to clubs and get drunk and do drugs have sex.
Yeah, they go to New York and have, not even clubs, they go to New York and get drunk and do drugs and things.
Yeah.
Like, it's the most bland, cliche version of hedonism imaginable.
Yeah.
Like,
no, there's no, like, we got together and used our supreme magical power to, like, create
the super
some
orgy.
Sort of, exactly.
Yeah.
No, we just went to some bars and got real drunk and found someone who would give us E.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Like, if I wanted to write a story where my character starts out as a hedonist, and I'm like, I just want to quickly sketch hedonism, that is the story I would write. New York... drugs, sex, boredom. It's so, like, just writing the words New and York, create it without having to do much of the rest. It's so, I'm just like, really?
Yeah.
That's it? That's your version of hedonism? You could grow tails if you wanted to.
Yeah.
You could grow yourself extra sets of sex organs and just go crazy. Maybe not. I think the rules of the magic in the universe prevent you from messing with your body too much. But
we can go into that in a minute.
Well, then again, he gave himself super stamina to run across Antarctica. Why not give himself super humping stamina?
Well, right. Also,
Mrs. Stauffer, don't listen to that.
Got turned into a goose. Like, they turned into bears and foxes. It's like,
that's a really good point.
You can change everything about your physicality and somehow also maintain the ability to turn back, even though. Like,
well,
you have a stupid goose brain.
Well, I think the goose bit was the teachers doing it.
The teachers did the geese, but they did the foxes and the bears and everything they did in Antarctica. It didn't say we were turned into bears. It said we turned ourselves into
bears.
That's
a good point.
They were even told when you have to run across Antarctica 200 miles or whatever, you can't turn yourself into anything else.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it comes to, like, little minor things, like, I don't like that I have one eye set slightly higher than the other or whatever, it's like, oh, you can't do that. It's something about making changes to what is yourself. It's, the whole thing is stupid.
The idea was that your face... Well... That one, I, you know, again, it's another example of an idea where I'm like, if you dive into it more and play with it, it's interesting, but the book doesn't do that. Like, the book entertains the idea that it's dangerous to make changes to your face, because your face in particular is very intimately connected to your sense of self, and so it can, it doesn't.
But you can turn it into a goose face with a beak on it.
Right.
Like, where's the line?
Right. But my point is that is an interesting idea that the book doesn't do interesting things with.
Right.
That's where I'm going with it. I agree with you that it's not internally consistent as a result of the goose business.
Right.
So we
were talking about how the characters are all terrible and unrelatable. Like, from the get-go, Quentin and his friends are the elite. Like, they start off as, like, rich enough to live reasonably in Park Slope, Brooklyn.
I don't even know what that means.
Park Slope, I think it's in Brooklyn. Park Slope is, like, a pretty well-off neighborhood in New York. And, like, even a not well-off neighborhood in New York is like, well, you know, your rent is $1 bazillion, and that's why you're trapped in poverty. They're super intelligent, and they don't have to try that hard. Like, talks about, this is the first time he'd ever had to really put effort into anything. And then they're on their way to an interview for an Ivy League school, and then he gets invited to take the test to get into Break Bills, which only the smartest people can get into. So you start off with the most, like, I hate to say this because I feel like there's so much attached to it in the outside world, but just in the world of the book, so privileged a group of people that you already, almost no one can connect to them on any level.
Right.
And then he just gripes about how, like, well, everything's not perfect all the time, and that makes me mad. Like, and then you get beyond into the hedonism and the whatever it is. They're not relatable characters. They all do crappy, horrible things to one another, to their friends. They're always backbiting and whispering about each other behind each other's backs. There's no genuine relationships. Like, Quentin and his girlfriend, she starts out as like, oh, she's kind of interesting because the way she got here was different. Like, she wasn't supposed to be here and she forced her way in and she's super shy. But then, like, by the time they start dating, it's like, oh, she came out of her shell to become another person that you don't like.
Right. And again, none of this, and I feel like I have to emphasize this because bad characters who you don't like can make for really interesting protagonists if you do something with it.
Also, they need a counterpoint.
Yeah, and you've got something for them to bounce off of that isn't just, you can't just drag us through the mud. You've got to leave a little bit of a door open at the end.
Yeah.
You got to give us a little spray down with the hose at the end there to shower off with.
Yeah.
And there's only hints and fragments of it here. Like, I feel like there's a character named Penny in the book who is an aggressive, angry punk who may or may not have autism. It's not entirely clear.
Yeah.
But he's not good at
either
picking
he
up
has
on things.
Autism and the author is really bad at writing about it, or he doesn't have autism and the author has no qualms about just being a real dick and throwing autistic around as a adjective to describe people who don't have autism.
Right. He's not as horrible as some of the others. He doesn't devolve into the hedonism and whatnot. He's like genuinely enthusiastic about getting to go to a magical other world where bears can talk to you.
Yeah.
So he's not quite as vile, but he's not in the book very much either. Like, he disappears for long periods of time.
And you're pretty much supposed to hate him.
So I liked him a lot.
Yeah, but you're not supposed to.
I don't know.
Like, is that not made clear by the?
I get that Quentin doesn't.
Everyone hates him. Quentin super hates him, but no one likes him. And, like, the other character, one of the other characters I like the most, like, the two other characters, not including Humbledrum, who we must get to at some point here.
Certainly.
The other two characters that I liked were Josh, who's barely ever in the book and is supposed to be kind of a bumbling loser, and what was the Christian wizard guy?
Richard.
You are clearly supposed to hate him from the moment he shows up. Mm-hmm. And every time I saw him, I was like, I don't know why he hangs out with these people, but he seems fine.
I agree with you on Josh. Like, he was a good comic relief type, and I'm like, I would like to know more.
Yeah.
Like, his relationship with the other characters is really interesting, too, because they're all high test score, high grade types. And Josh is like, I shouldn't be here.
I actually have to try.
My grades are crap. I only test well. I don't know how I do it. I'm so scared. I'm so scared all the time. I'm going to flunk out.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yep.
That's a dynamic that's intriguing. The difference between people who can thrive in these kind of bureaucratic, measured environments.
Josh should have been the main character because alone, yeah. the like,
yeah.
I don't understand how or why I do magic when I do magic, but when it does happen, occasionally, it's unbelievably powerful compared right. to everyone else's magic.
Mm-hmm.
That. Explore that for a book and make Quentin go drown himself in the frickin' river.
Mm-hmm.
Like, anyone else was better.
Right. I would have been interested.
But, so you were making a point again. I was saying I didn't mind the Richard.
Richard, yes.
All that much.
Yeah. So yeah, Josh was interesting. Richard, I felt like, could have been interesting, except he annoyed me because he felt like the requisite whipping boy for religion
in
the book.
He absolutely was that.
And there wasn't enough of him for me to care, really.
Right. I'm
like,
yeah, I don't think he was a developed or interesting character, but mm-hmm. I felt like he was brought in to be the whipping boy, and we were supposed to hate him, but except for one scene where he was drunk and started a really insipid and stupid conversation.
It was terrible.
Which was terrible.
Yeah.
But even you couldn't really even blame him for it because it was just like, he got drunk and did this. I couldn't tell if, like, the author was like trying to pull his punches on that or just truly doesn't understand
mm-hmm.
like religion at all.
Right.
And so was just trying to make like points that he saw other people make on Reddit one time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. So yeah, I don't think he was a character really at all, but I didn't hate him. Like I felt like I was supposed to hate him.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I would go so far as to say supposed to, cause I'm gun shy about
sure.
that kind of
yep.
intent, but I didn't have much reaction other than, oh, this is a straw man, and
yeah.
he's not giving me enough to think he's anything but a straw man.
Yep. Which, but just by the way, Christian wizard, potential super interesting content to write about.
Yeah.
He didn't, but he could have.
What is that? How does that wizard square that with
how
the
does
whole,
he reconcile those?
Like,
what brand of that was he to begin with? Like, mm-hmm. is he a Southern Baptist who discovered he had magical powers and had to figure those things out and still managed to make them work? Or is he, like, a Unitarian?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a whole huge...
Yeah, and there's at least one verse in the Bible that's like, no witches.
Yeah.
Witches get stitches.
Right.
I believe.
That's in Hezekiah 16.
I think so.
Yeah.
Right.
The book of Hezekiah. It's the fastest growing book in the Bible, you know.
There's a joke here I'm not getting.
It's not actually a book of the Bible, so whenever something vaguely biblical comes up, we just say it's from the book of Hezekiah.
Oh, you people are beautiful and wonderful. Hold on. I have to enjoy that for a moment longer before we go back to this other book, the book of Hezekiah. You know, the funny part is I didn't catch that either. And
right.
And I'm reasonably bright.
A lot of people who should know better don't get it, which is part of one of the best things. You're like, yeah, it's in Hezekiah. And they're like,
wait, Hezekiah?
Oh, yeah. I think I read that. I'm like, no, you didn't. There's no book of Hezekiah. You moron.
Oh, that's good.
Go with God.
That is good. That is grade A work right there. Like, there's levels. Oh, God, it's got a taste to it. It's sweet like candy in my mouth.
I can't take much. I can't take credit for it. It's definitely a thing I enjoy. But shout out to, I'm not going to use names, but if you're listening, you know who you are, who have also been involved.
Sure.
So back to the magicians.
The magicians.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can we talk about magic a bit here?
Yeah. So let me give you a quick rundown of the magic system in. The world. So to do magic in the world of the magicians, you need to do the proper hand gestures as usual
mm-hmm.
for a magic system. You need to say
they made it much more complex than swish and flick. You know,
yes.
like he went. Excuse me.
He had to spit out his tobacco juice.
Yeah, I was. I had some chaw.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he went great lengths to make it clear that like these are very difficult. Like he didn't make. This comparison, but like learning an instrument, like
yeah.
like getting really not just like I can sit down at the piano, but like being a classical piano
right.
prodigy
it was,
or whatever.
It was to the level of you need to develop new muscles in your hands to
yeah.
contort your fingers this way, type of gestures.
Yeah.
So you need to do the proper gestures. You need to say the proper words in whatever dead language they happen to be in.
Right.
Sure. Or modern language, whatever. It's all just learn Dutch and Aramaic. and Persian.
Right.
Farsi, sorry. And
a half Aramaic is not a modern language, by the way.
Well, yeah, I was just picking languages that from the book. Learn all of these, and you also have to take into account what he refers to as the circumstances, which could be anything. The phases of the moon, the positions of Pluto, the prevailing weather, the continent you're on, the planet you're on, the planets you're not on.
The universe you're in, once they get into that.
Yeah, the universe you're in, your blood type, maybe.
Yeah, like, there's a lot.
And so the idea is that you have to... this is actually, I think, a place where we may have a disagreement on the book, actually, for once, as opposed to just... blindly hating it. And so the idea is that you have to learn, you have to memorize. So at Breakbills, at the College of Magic, you memorize all of these circumstances and are able to, and then can run down your tables in your mind and apply them to your magic and do your thing.
It's like memorizing a very complicated multiplication table.
Yeah. And then applying it on the fly to the operations of your tablet.
Yeah.
So they go to Antarctica at one point, and the professor there, Mayakovsky, is like, if you want to be a real magician, gets to the point where he wants something and it happens. There's no thinking about it in between A and B. And I think you were criticizing that point because it made the magic system incomplete or inconsistent. Was that it?
No, I liked that.
Oh,
like,
okay.
I don't know. I guess what I didn't like was that a magician can do anything, but then... both before and after, they'd be like, oh, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't make food. But then sometimes they make food. That was inconsistent. Mm-hmm. But I thought what they did in Breakbills South was actually good. It was one of the few decently, like, it made sense and it was consistent because it was a lot like learning an instrument. Like, you go from having to memorize these tables and just trying to recall them to just knowing.
You just can do the thing. Yeah.
While you're here, you are going to be completely silent, and this is all you can focus on, and you just have to practice these things again and again and again and again in different circumstances until it becomes second nature.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, I related to that quite well because if you go back to the music analogy, I'm not good at reading music.
Mm-hmm.
And so I either have to sit and really kind of work at plunk, plunk, plunk. I'm pretty bad at multiplication in my head. I never memorized multiplication tables, and so I work it out. But people who are good at math get to a point where they just hear this times that and know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily, oh, I can recall what that is, wrote from the table. It's, I've done this enough that it's just, I understand.
Right.
Working at it enough that it's just like muscle memory, you know, it's inherent. I liked that. I thought that was
have misunderstood another comment you made because I thought we had a disagreement there, but we're actually on exactly the same page.
Yep. As we continue to just dump on this book, except that one little part.
It's just we're dunking on this guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the magic system is intriguing to me. Like, that's all pretty cool. But as Johannes is saying, there's a lot of inconsistencies where it's not clear what the boundaries are. And some of that can be chalked up to there's bits about where it's like, well, there is a mystery about exactly where the power comes from,
right?
Which they don't delve into, which I'm fine with. Magic always has that. Also, sometimes physics work differently, and we don't want to explain it because we'll be here all day. Element to it, but there's also an element of some people just get to do it better than others, and that's unfair. And
the end.
End of list.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, that works. If you're doing any skill-based story where it's like, how good are you at the skill? Sometimes you're just not as good at other people as the skill. Like, I was a cross-country runner back in the day. I was not going to be faster than our fastest guys. They were just faster than me.
Right.
Even if I'd trained up, my legs didn't pump as quickly as theirs did.
Right.
That's genetics. No moral, the end.
There are just things that some people are inherently better at.
So I was pretty fine with that. But like Johannes was saying, occasionally there are just weird limits that seem arbitrary and don't seem skill-based and don't really work.
And well, it's not just that. It's not just like this guy can make food and that guy can't. It's like in this situation, someone magically made a feast appear. But then next time when we're out in the wilderness and we need food, you can't make food by magic. That's impossible.
The biggest one that stood out to me was they are getting ready to go to Fillory.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, they have to jump through a fountain to get there.
Yep.
It's a thing. They've equipped themselves for this journey. They have backpacks full of food and survival gear and cold weather gear, most importantly. Like, they go on and on about getting cold weather gear. And then they get to the fountain, and they set somebody through first, right?
Yeah.
And they
Penny went through first and said, it's summer, we can all go.
Yeah, and so they dump the cold weather gear in a heap and go through, and then it's winter because time travel flows differently between the two places.
Yeah.
And so now they're very cold. There are two problems with this scenario, one of which is solved by them not being idiots, and one of which is solved by them remembering things that they've already done.
Yep.
If they're not idiots, they just take the cold weather gear through, and then if it's still summer,
they dump it there.
They leave it in a pile the way they have it. Because they're traveling to another world.
Yep.
Maybe things are wacky there.
Yeah.
You don't know. Maybe the nights get really, really cold and you'll want a parka.
Also, they already knew there was a time differential because it's referenced at least twice before in the book.
Yep. And in the books, Fillory and further, the books that they read in as children, all of them. And the second thing that would be solved is if they remembered the time when they were in Antarctica and they lived in Antarctica, where
like
it's very cold.
Like a few chapters ago?
Yeah, where it's really cold in Antarctica because it's Antarctica and there's snow everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to go outside naked a bunch of times and survive out there.
And you could say, oh, but magic works differently in Fillory and they had to figure it out. But first of all, they didn't know that. So why didn't they at least try to make themselves warm with magic before realizing they needed to figure out new circumstances? And second of all, that's stupid. It's just badly written. Don't make excuses for this guy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but that could have been interesting if they had gone through and been like, oh, let's use our magic to stay warm. Oh, shoot. I just set myself on fire because the spell works differently here. Oh, no. Like now, like you, from a creative writing standpoint, at that point, you've accomplished two things. One, you've given me, the reader, more information about Fillory and the setting that I didn't have before, and you've done it in an exciting way, you know, that moves the plot forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just characters talking, it's action and things happening and characters learning and reacting to circumstances.
Right.
And I forget the second one. I actually lost track. I think that was the main one.
It's
was the big
catching.
One.
The thing I have, you now have also.
Yeah, right. The powerful brain hunger.
I was just writing something in my notes here, so I would remember to talk about it. And I've written the word reveal, and I forgot what the other thing was.
Is it possible?
Like the rest of the sentence.
Do you think it's possible this book was really good and we just forgot?
No, absolutely not.
Doubtful? Okay.
So, in my notes, you talked about how they don't really explore how magic works. There's a thing that we talked about, but we hadn't finished the book yet, and now I think we can talk about it a little more.
Sure.
Early on, in one of their first classes, they are told, we don't really understand how or why magic works. Don't look into it. Not just don't worry about it, don't explore it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, some magicians have tried and have wasted their lives. And I read that, and I thought, okay, that's stupid, and it would be easy enough for them to just do that, and then when Quentin finishes school, that's going to be what the story is about. He's going to be like, I'm going to be the one who figures out how magic works. Except he doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
It's never mentioned again. It's literally never mentioned again.
They never
just
go
like,
back
there. Don't try to figure out how it works, because you can't figure out how it works.
I was less bothered by that than you are. If only because I guess I think of it as, if you're going to have magic in your story, that question is always there.
It's kind of the same. It's kind of the polar opposite of a wizard did it.
Yeah. It's,
but it felt so clumsy.
Yeah.
Because sorry to keep interrupting.
No, go ahead.
Not letting you interrupt me, I guess. It's kind of like how, I've totally lost it. Damn it.
Sorry.
This is the worst. A wizard did it.
A wizard did do it. To me, it's sort of like...
I got it. Sorry. The author's approach to describing magic was so scientific.
Mm-hmm.
With the specific hand movements and the having to understand all of the circumstances and everything else about it was... And like they even talked about it like a science, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
They were very, very scientific about their approach to magic. And then... And like they'd been, especially in that chapter... building up to it, was like, it's not just wand waving and saying some funny words. Like they even specifically called out like fake Latin words, like Harry Potter, who's just like, haha, Harry Potter, you're stupid. All this very systematic approach to it. And then it gets to like, but why does it work? Never look into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was why it annoyed me, because it was just like, no, that's not the attitude of the sorts of people who have that sort of academic approach to these things. I don't care how many wizards wasted their lives trying.
The rest of them
also
will.
The rest of them
will.
Would also do that. That's the whole point.
Right.
And they're just like, nope, don't. And it's never touched again.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't bother me as much if I didn't know that he wrote the first book without any intention of writing other books.
Mm-hmm.
But he did. So the first book has to stand alone, even though it now doesn't.
Right, right.
And that's just stupid and garbage. What sure. were you going
to
say?
To me, it's a bit like I see where you're coming from, and to an extent I agree, but to me, asking where magic originates from is a bit like asking why doesn't Gandalf use magic to solve more of their problems in Lord of the Rings? Because, uh-huh. oh my God, why? Please help us, wizard that we brought along. Because the story doesn't work if you do that. Like, there've got to be irrational limitations on magic if it's going to be at all an element that works in the story.
Yeah, but you can write them better. Plus, there are sure. very clear. They're not stated in the Lord of the Rings or the Hobbit necessarily, but there are reasons that you can either work out or find by reading the mm-hmm. Silmarillion or whatever else.
Sure.
For why Gandalf doesn't just use magic to solve all their problems. Mm-hmm. Like, they exist. They're just not explored there, and they're also not just glossed over or bluntly, deliberately, not just ignored, but you're told to ignore them. They're just not important right now.
Right.
Which is very different. If Frodo or Bilbo said, Gandalf, why don't you just use magic to solve all the problems? And Gandalf was like, don't think about it ever. Other wizards have wasted their life trying to figure out why I don't use magic to solve all the problems.
Frodo would be like, I'm not a wizard. I was just asking a question, G.
Can we have crumpets? Do they ever have crumpets?
I don't think they ever have crumpets.
It seems like the sort of thing a hobbit would eat.
It does.
They're like condensed British people.
They're just pocket Brits.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that was Tolkien's whole thing. Like, he was like, I could just write about hobbits and their stupid crap all day, but even my most tolerant readers get a little impatient with that.
I have a friend who I still do not understand her, but she would have loved that. Like, when I was in high school, and mm-hmm. not all of the Lord of the Rings movies were out, but like one or two were, and we were all talking about it, and she goes, oh, I won't see those. I don't really like, you know, those like big grand adventure movies. And we're like, you don't like the Lord of the Rings? Like, that's really good. And everyone in our friend group was like, of course they're amazing. There was no like, it's boring and long or anything. And she goes, let me put it to you this way. My favorite part of The Hobbit is at the beginning when he's in his little house making tea and doing the dishes. And I was like, oh, there are people like you in the world. This is new information that I don't know what to do with. But yeah, she would gladly have read a Hobbit length book where he never leaves the Shire.
That's kind of endearing.
Yeah.
Which actually brings us back to the magicians in kind of a roundabout way. So you know the bit in Harry Potter where they go in Deathly Hallows, where they go on like a 400-page camping trip or whatever?
Yeah.
That was one of my favorite parts of the whole series.
Yeah.
Because there's a sense of danger, but it's a little bit removed, but it's also there. And the character, there's some tense psychological stuff going on.
Yeah.
And I liked it a lot. Normally, I enjoy those respite but not really segments of stories. You know what I mean? If that makes kind of sense?
Respite, but yes.
Sure. There's one of those somewhere in here. I can't remember where it was now, all of a sudden.
The house in... well, no, they're all crappy to each other at that point, so probably not that.
Well, yeah, but that was it. That was what broke it for me.
The big house before they finally go to Fillory.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, okay, this is a long section where they're just sort of treading water a little bit. This is my jam. And I'm like, ruined it. You ruined my jam.
Yeah.
It's bad jam. It's like pomegranate and cheese jam.
It already wasn't. That might not be bad. I mean, as long as it doesn't go bad.
I think if you mix cheese into the jam, like, that's not great.
It'd just be like a cheesecake.
Okay, well, it's a bad jam.
So let's end on a positive note, because we've been going for quite a while
here. How long have we been going?
49 minutes right now.
I have more to talk about.
Oh, I know. Do you have anything else you want to hit before we move on and finish with the bear?
I wanted to talk a little bit about the sentence level stuff.
Oh, yeah, do it.
Because our dear guide through this world is not the greatest sentence crafter in the world. It's rookie level from here. Like, here's one. He's talking about something. I don't even know what, but I marked it in my book. Crows perched on power lines, stepped in dog windblown trash, the corpses of innumerable wet oak leaves being desecrated in innumerable ways by innumerable vehicles and pedestrians. Fine. There's a lot going on in that sentence.
Crows stepped in a lot of stuff.
Yeah, that's the problem. Crows perched on power lines, comma, stepped in dog. Now, we get what he means there. He's listing off things that are in the urban environment.
Yep.
But there's a half-second click in the human brain where you see crows perched on power lines, comma, stepped in dog, it connects stepped in dog back to perched. So now right. The crows are perched on stepped in dog. What? Oh, no. Now I get it. You got to pay attention to that crap.
Yeah.
Those million little tiny things in reading are what make or break the book.
Yeah.
And it was bothersome.
Can I jump in on that?
Yeah,
real
go
quick?
Ahead.
The dog could be not totally unnecessary. Quentin is not the one narrating. He's just the protagonist.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of times like it stuck out really early on in the book where he could have said have sex, but he said he could have said excrement or anything else. And especially given his penchant for going way out of the way to use big words, big obscure words.
And that, yeah, absolutely.
But then also, why not?
And that echoes to another problem where we're not. We're sometimes we're really close. We're like right behind the iris in Quentin's head.
Yeah.
And sometimes we're a little more distant. For example, we get he's referring to a teacher that he's got the hots for at this point, and Mrs. Stafford,
who's never mentioned again.
Close your ears for this bit. He refers to her achingly full and gropable breasts when he knew he should be devoting himself to blah blah blah.
Yeah.
Which is a sentence I actually have no problem with.
Right.
If you're putting me really close and consistently in the mind of this character, where I'm meant to take that as, okay, this guy needs to
do something.
He needs to not be thinking about groping his teacher's breast.
Right.
That is revealing character to me. But we're far enough away from Quentin for so much of the time that I'm just like, is this Quentin or Lev talking here?
Yeah.
Lev the writer. I don't know about Lev himself. I don't mean to comment on your character if you're listening. But the sense of distance is muddy throughout the book. Similarly, in the next bit, a teacher tells him, go like this, and then demonstrates a hand motion. And then it goes into Quentin's head for a minute, and then it says, he went like this.
Mm-hmm.
Referring back to he does the motion.
Right.
Which, again, works if we're tight in Quentin's perspective for the whole time enough that I get it. But here, the perspective is loosey-goosey enough that it doesn't do it. It doesn't accomplish what it needs to, at least if you're me.
Well, there's also a point, I mentioned this, I think you didn't notice it as much.
Mm-hmm.
There's a few points where the perspective is loose enough just in general, like that things get confusing, where I don't know if he's trying to create some suspense or what, but he'll introduce a character, for instance.
Yeah.
And he does this in different situations too, but for the sake of example, he'll introduce a character and you'll be like, okay, I have a picture of this character now, enough to keep making my way through the book and see what happens. And then like three pages later, he'll reveal something about the character that's not like a revelation to the characters. Mm-hmm. It's not a revelation to Quentin, but it's brand new information to the reader.
Right.
But it's not important information. It's just like, it's not information that he would have missed. It's just, oh, by the way, this was the case. And so instead of just being like, I know a new thing that changes what I think about this character slightly, it's like, oh, I have to completely reconsider everything I read about this character for the last 3-5 pages because this is a thing that I would have known as soon as I saw them, but wasn't described and is notably different.
Right.
And it's just like, oh, wait, what? How did that happen? Why are we doing this? Go ahead.
To add to that, too, there's a bad sense throughout the book of when to present something as a direct scene, when to present it as a high-level summary,
yeah,
and when to present it as a flashback or a story told by somebody else.
Yeah.
And it just sucks the momentum out of the story because we get so much that we want to see either directly or see as presented through a character's eyes, so we learn both more about this thing being presented and more about the character doing the presenting.
Right.
That just isn't. And here's a great example. There's a bit in the book where the beast, the villain of the story, comes through an evil mirror or something and rampages through a classroom murdering people.
I wanted to bring this up too. Go ahead.
Yeah. And so the students are trapped in the classroom. The beast erects a shield around it so nobody can get in. And they find out, and so Quentin spends the whole time just sitting there paralyzed while the beast walks around breaking stuff, just generally being creepy and weird. It's a weird scene. And it works, actually, in many ways. Afterward, we find out that the teachers of the school spent the whole time trying to break into the room and drive it off, as you would hope they would do.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get this bit, referring to the dean of the school, Henry Fogg, is the character. By all accounts, Fogg made a surprisingly competent battlefield commander, calm, organized, rapid and accurate in his assessment of the situation, skillful in his deployment of the resources at his disposal. That's a fine sentence. There's nothing wrong with that sentence, but I need that whole bit. I need more detail there.
Yeah.
And it's the kind of thing where if you present it as another character, say a medic character, telling Quentin about Dean Fogg as a battlefield commander, it tells me about that that medic who might, maybe you can bring back later then, because now I know that person. It tells me, it lets me reveal stuff about Quentin by his reactions and interactions with that character, and it's just smoother and cleaner.
Well, another example based on that very thing. Mm-hmm. So this beast appears in the classroom, and they're all frozen in place for quite a length of time. But at some point, and none of them can move, let alone try to do any magic.
Right.
But at some point, one of the other students who we'd sort of heard about here and there, that she's like very skilled and kind of a battle mage kind of person, he hears her all of a sudden, no one can move, but then he hears her voice like casting a spell, and then suddenly she's silenced. And then it's, you know, they're frozen and silent for another several hours. And you're going, what happened? Did he stop her? Did he kill her? Did he eat her? What happened?
Yes.
And on the one hand, it's a little telegraphed and you're pretty sure what happened. But on the other hand, it's never addressed. And so they talk about how Fogg was a surprisingly competent battlefield commander or whatever and all this stuff. And it goes all the way through, not just like everything that happened, but also how they responded to it and how like they came down from the terrifying high and everyone kind of got back to the normal swing of things. And it's not until pages later at the end of the chapter where it's like, by the way, all that stuff we said about everyone calming down and going back to normal, I meant everyone except that character, because she was dead because the beast ate her alive. And you're like, that you can't reveal that now, because none of what you just told us about the rest of the student body recovering makes any damn sense in that context. You can't reveal it. That's not writing. That's garbage.
Yeah.
Go home.
It's summary where you need scene.
Yeah.
Is what it is. Is to put it in obnoxious creative writing school terms.
Actual writer terms?
Sure.
I'm willing to be on your side this time.
Oh, fair enough.
Because
okay.
This book was garbage. Woo-hoo!
Yeah, and there's just so many examples that I'm clicking through my highlights on my Kindle with. He's talking about a spell that a friend of his who didn't get into Breakbill shows him when he's on a break at home. She must have found it online. Some genuine magical information did circulate in the straight world, mostly on the internet, though it was buried in so much bogus crap that nobody could tease out the real stuff, blah, blah, blah. Show me that. At least give me a conversation where Quentin and another student at Breakbills talk about bogus stuff out in the real world so that I'm primed when I get to him meeting up with his old friend to see she casts all. I am already thinking it. I'm going to think, oh, she must have gotten that on the internet.
But yeah. Also,
meeting with some weirdos.
This is how many years in? Four?
Yeah, something like that.
He's like 4 years in, 4 out of 5 years at Breakbills. Three or four.
Right.
And it even comments on like the poor thing. She'd probably spent wasted years of her life learning that one little spell that might as well be prestidigitation. It just makes sparkles appear.
Right.
And then a few more years, but not that many later, at the end of the book, he encounters her again. And she's a super powerful witch who can fly.
Which is cool.
But if it takes a person outside of Breakbill's 4 to 5 years of wasted time to learn how to make their fingers sparkle, what the hell happened? Maybe she can only now fly and make her fingers sparkle.
Those are the two things she can do.
Yeah.
It's not great.
So there's so much garbage about this book, we could keep going for another hour. But we should.
I'm just checking if there was anything else I insist on talking about here. Oh, structure. Overall structure. Big picture thing. You cannot give me a school story and a going to a magic world story.
Oh, they were two different books.
Both of them in full in the same book. Either you condense one or you condense the other, and you condense the school story because school stories are only interesting in full.
Yeah, that was the thing. There was no story arc. There was no conflict until the last quarter of this book.
Yeah. Book 4, where they actually go to Fillory, is the first book of a better book.
Yeah. The first 3 books of this book, which is confusing, by the way. We're not talking about the trilogy that now exists.
Yeah.
The initial book was broken up into 4 books.
Right.
The first 3 are like, it was either, if you're expecting Harry Potter, why are you going through so many years of school so quickly? Or if you're expecting Narnia, why are we spending so much time at this school?
Oh, we haven't even touched on the adult Narnia yet, or the adult Harry Potter and adult themes in fantasy literature, how this is not adult fantasy.
It's not adult.
It's a bad Redditor's idea of
adult
fantasy.
It's adult like Playboy is adult, and that's probably not being fair to Playboy.
Yeah,
it's adult in that there are boobies.
Yeah, it's adult if you think that tits, drugs, and booze make it adult.
Yeah.
And maybe a few swears thrown in there, which they make it so you can't sell it to children.
Yeah.
But
made it, frankly, across the board, more juvenile than Harry Potter.
Yeah, it does not rise to the level of I am intrigued by the themes and the characters here. I will forget Quentin ever existed, except that I didn't like him within a month.
Yeah.
I want to talk more about that, but
we're at an hour right
okay,
now.
We should probably call it good. Overall, we would not recommend the Magicians.
We got to talk about the bear.
We go, Humbledrum, the one bright spot in a world of darkness.
The best part of the book.
So they get to Fillory, and they get to a little tavern, and they meet a talking bear.
He's a talking bear. He wears a waistcoat.
His name is Humbledrum. It's the most Narnia thing that's ever happened of Narnia.
He only drinks mead, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Or something.
Yeah.
Something a bear would drink.
But he drinks it out of tiny little...
out of thimbles.
Yeah, just little tiny. It's adorable. And he has to pick it up with his big old claws.
Not a thing that looks like a thimble because he's a bear. Actual thimble-sized glasses.
Yeah, it's great. And he says stuff like, I am a respectable bear. And like, he's always... he's humble. So he's like, actually, grizzlies are a kind of brown bear, but they're much bigger than me.
It felt like sort of a disgusting, misunderstood farce of Aslan and like the descriptions of Aslan. Oh, not a tame lion.
Mm-hmm.
Where he's not a tame lion. Be like, oh, I'm a respectable bear. But it wasn't a...
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a comparison that made any sense.
It was a charming and endearing character.
Yeah.
We liked Humbledrum a lot. He was on the page for like two pages.
Yeah, like maybe, two and a half.
And then he went away and was gone forever. And then...
never mentioned
then
again.
Later there was a big fire giant. And we got a detailed description of his... balls.
Yep.
And...
that was a quote.
I'm not just being vulgar there. The phrase, I think it was huge red... balls was written.
And then later on a character says... did you see his...
that guy was
that
hung?
That guy was hung.
Something like that, yeah. So, don't read The Magicians.
Don't.
Read better fantasy.
Or anything.
If you want to read fantasy, don't go down this dark road.
Well...
has Love Grossman been thoroughly dunked on?
I guess. I won't say thoroughly because I literally feel like we could go for at least another hour.
I feel bad because I don't like putting negative reviews out into the world. I don't think they add as much as other things. But at the same time, come on.
Yeah.
Just.
I'm right there with
also,
you.
Also, Lev Grossman already had this book made into a TV show. And it got a bunch of great reviews when it came out in 2009. So I don't think it's
on the New York Times bestseller list. And he has all the money in the world.
I don't think we're going to hurt his feelings.
Yeah.
But if your feelings are hurt, Lev, I'm sorry.
And I'm not. Your book was garbage.
He's meaner than me.
It's true. But also more truthful. So if you are Lev Grossman, please contact us and let us know how much we've hurt you on Twitter at Mildly Alarming.
Please don't do that at by email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
Or do it on Facebook at facebook.com/mildlyalarmingshow. You can also Lev shouldn't rate us, but other people should, and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and Google Play Music.
Or you can just take into account the phases of the moon, the positions of the seasons, and whether or not there still is a sun. Wiggle your fingers and say some old Babylonian sayings, and nothing will happen because magic isn't real and we live in a world of darkness and fear.
Also, we have a website at www.mildlyalarming.com. See you next week. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Hey guys, Johannes here. Like, the real Johannes. Speaking for the real Mildly Alarming podcast. I just want to say that, and we keep track of these things, that last hug you gave was just great. Really top notch. Good duration, firm without being smothering, no creepy inhale near the other person's neck. Just a great hug all around. Well done.